Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Update on Primary Central Nervous System Lymphoma, or PCNSL. And this program was made possible by Decipherer, a member of Ono Pharmacy US, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. To start, I just want to let everyone know how many people we have on the call. We have over 130 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Canada and the Philippines, so it is a global call. We are delighted to have all of you on this program today, and you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Alvaro Alencar, and Dr. Alencar is Associate Professor, Clinical Medicine Chief Medical Officer, Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, member, Lymphoma Committee at Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology, Hematology Section Lead, Sylvester's Global Oncology Program. And Dr. Alencar will be discussing an overview of primary central nervous system lymphoma, or PCNSL, as well as managing symptoms and treatment side effects. It is my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Alencar.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining. I'd like to thank Johnny and the Cancer Care team for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm Alvaro Alencar. I'm a hematologist oncologist, and I take care of patients with lymphoma with a special focus in primary CNS lymphoma. So I'll start by saying something that's simple, but I think it's still very important, is that if you're on this call as a patient or someone who loves a patient, you're already doing the most useful thing that you can do. You're learning, understanding, knowing what you're dealing with takes some of that fear away from it and also helps us. When we know what we're fighting against, we know what we have, it just empowers us to just do it better. So what I'll try to do over the next few minutes is try to really share with you some of this important knowledge for you to have. So I have two main jobs today. First is to explain what primary CNS lymphoma actually is, and then I'll talk about symptoms, how we manage the side effects of treatment, because that's where a lot of the day-to-day worry lives, obviously. So, and then after me, you'll hear my colleagues, they'll go deeper into the value of research. I know we're just asking about what you know about research and how do you get the most out of your care team. We were also asking if you know how to reach your team. So, and this is something that is very important. So the idea is that I'll just kind of lay the groundwork for them to expand on. So let's start with what is this disease? So lymphoma is a cancer of the lymphocytes. Lymphocytes are a type of white blood cell, and they are part of our immune system. So lymphoma is a cancer of the immune system. Most lymphomas will show up in the lymph nodes. Those are the small glands where the lymphocytes tend to live, and they are in your neck, in your armpits, in your groin. Sometimes you have an infected tooth and you feel the lump, and that's really the immune system fighting that infection. So primary CNS lymphoma is a little different. So the letter CNS stands for central nervous system, and that represents the brain, the spinal cord, and also the eyes. Primary means that the lymphoma started there and has stayed there, so it's confined to the CNS. It's confined to one of those areas, or more than one of those areas, but those areas. And in almost every case, the type of lymphoma, we have many different types of lymphoma, but in most cases, the type of lymphoma for the primary CNS lymphoma is called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So you may hear the team talk about that, not only as PCNSL or primary CNS lymphoma, but also diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And why does this location matter so much? And I think here's a key idea to understand the entire concept of the treatment. Our brain is protected by something that is called the blood-brain barrier. It's like a security gate around the brain. It keeps harmful things from your bloodstream from getting into the brain, so there can be bacteria, viruses, drugs. So this protects our brain. It's wonderful for our everyday life, but it creates a problem for us when we're treating the lymphoma, because many cancer medicines cannot get through that gate, cannot get through that barrier and get into the central nervous system. So when we're treating a lymphoma inside the brain, it's not the same as treating a lymphoma in a lymph node, what we call a systemic disease. We have to choose treatments specifically designed to cross that barrier and reach the disease inside the central nervous system. And I'll come back to that a little bit when we talk about the treatment. So how do we find it? Most patients will come to us because something changed. And I'll describe these changes in a moment when we talk a little bit about the symptoms. But generally, one of the most important tests when we're trying to understand these changes, usually these neurologic changes, will be an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. So it's a picture of the brain. So the MRI will show there are some characteristic features, some features that really look like lymphoma. So if it shows something that looks like lymphoma, well, we need to confirm it with a biopsy. So these are generally done by a neurosurgeon, and they put they get a tiny sample, mainly with a needle, and we would look at this under the microscope, and we want to be certain it's a lymphoma, because the treatment for a brain lymphoma is very different than the treatment for the other types of brain tumors. So, and we not only look into the brain, but also in the other two places that the disease likes to hide. We talked about the spine, so we will sample the spinal fluid. That's the clear fluid that protects your brain, that kind of sits between your brain and your skull. So we do a lumbar puncture. It's kind of like the same thing as an epidural when women want to deliver the baby, and we get a sample of the spinal fluid, and we can see on the microscope if we see lymphoma cells there. And also, because the eyes are part of the central nervous system, we also generally we'll have an eye doctor do a careful eye exam and look for lymphoma cells inside the eye. In our center, in most large centers, we work hand in hand with eye specialists exactly for this reason when we're managing CNS lymphoma. And it's all the same disease, whether it's on the fluid, on the brain, on the eye. And none of this is to really alarm you. It's just to help you understand that we want to understand the full picture before we define the treatment. So now I think what most people want to hear, so how do we treat it? How do we really treat primary CNS lymphoma? I don't have to tell you primary CNS lymphoma is very serious, but thankfully it's very treatable and it can respond very well to therapy, and I really want you to hold on to that. And the foundation for treatment is a chemotherapy medicine called methotrexate, and it's usually given in high doses. Methotrexate is a very interesting drug. It's one of the most flexible medications that mankind knows. We can use doses of like 12 milligrams to treat arthritis, and we're going to use doses in the thousands when we're treating cancer. And usually these doses in the thousands are the ones that cross this blood-brain barrier. But it can be done very safely from the 12 milligrams to the thousands when we're doing it. So it's a medication that we know how to give in a very safe way. So the high doses will cross the barrier that I mentioned and reach the lymphoma. But when we give it by itself, it has activity, but if we combine it, the combination of agents makes it even more effective. So we very frequently will combine it with an antibody called rituximab, which helps the immune system target the lymphoma cells. And we can choose additional medications based on the situation. The combinations are more effective, but they can also be more toxic. So the team will carefully see which combination fits the case best. And the treatment will usually come in phases. There's the first phase that we call induction. It's an intensive part, and it aims really at knocking the disease down as much as we can. Then we come to a second phase that we deepen and try to solidify this response that we call consolidation. And for some patients, this may include a stem cell transplant, and it's a transplant out of your own cells. The fancy name for it is high-dose chemotherapy with stem cell rescue, And the idea is that we use even higher doses of chemotherapy to kill some cells that may have survived the standard doses. And when we give these very high doses, the bone marrow has a hard time recovering. So we use the stem cells from the own patient to help the marrow recover after the chemotherapy. It is certainly very intensive, and not every patient may be a good candidate for it. So for those patients that may not be candidate for a transplant, we can use other approaches such as intermediate doses of chemotherapy or a maintenance therapy. So the team will tailor this to the age, to the health conditions, and how the patients respond to therapy. And this is something that's very important. I've been saying team because it's never one doctor working alone. The care comes from really from a multidisciplinary team. There are the cancer doctors, the advanced practice providers, so the nurse practitioners, PAs, the brain specialists, the neurologists, so the transplant specialists, so the eye doctors, the neurosurgeons, nurses, the pharmacists, physical therapy, everybody coordinating. So that's when you hear the word multidisciplinary, that's really what it means, that it's a lot of people looking after you. So let me just focus now on my second job, which is the symptoms and the side effects, because I know that's where most of where a lot of you can do and recognize and want to make sure you're familiar with it. So let me start with symptoms from the disease itself. Because this lymphoma is in the brain, most of the symptoms are neurological. Obviously, we talked about the eyes, so you can have visual changes, but most common is change in thinking or memory or even in personality. Families will sometimes notice this before the patient does. The patient may seem more confused, more forgetful, just not themselves. But other common symptoms could be weakness on one side of the body, headaches, and sometimes a seizure. Fatigue or this deep tiredness is also very common. And if you are a caregiver, you're an important set of eyes here. So if you see those changes, it really let us know, and because that helps us enormously in understanding what is happening. It's kind of the idea that if you see something, say something. If we talk a little bit about the side effects of treatment and what to do about them, is that one of the important initial drugs that we use when managing primary CNS lymphoma is steroids. One of the main ones that we use is called dexamethasone, and we use this really early on. Steroids can work really quickly to reduce the swelling of the brain and rapidly alleviate some of the symptoms, but they can also cause a lot of trouble sleeping, and they bring a big appetite, but they can cause mood changes and sometimes some aggressiveness, short temper, can change your blood sugar, raise your blood sugar, change the blood pressure. So we cannot use this drug forever, but it's a very good bridge to cool the disease down until we really start the therapy. The side effects are transient, but they're important. So if you're having problems with the steroids, you can talk to the team because sometimes we can adjust the dose a little. We cannot stop steroids abruptly, but we can kind of slowly taper it off until we stop it completely. But they are an important initial step in the treatment. And then comes the chemotherapy, and the chemotherapy itself can lower the blood counts, bring some immune suppression that can increase the risk of infection. Can also, some of the therapies can drop all their blood counts, like red cells, platelets. Sometimes you may even need transfusions depending on the therapy that you're getting. But the drop in counts, the immunosuppression is important because of the risk of infection. So if you have a fever, please call the team right away. It doesn't matter what time of the day, because don't wait until the morning. Fever during chemotherapy is something that we take very seriously. It's very treatable, but we have to tackle it right away. And the other side effects that we manage very frequently are nausea. We have very good medications for that. And some of these drugs can cause mouth sores. There's something we can do to at least alleviate a little, soothe a little bit. Unfortunately, we cannot prevent it completely, but at least we can alleviate some of that. And let me just say something specifically about high-dose methotrexate, because it's the backbone of the treatment and also something that sounds really scary, high dose. But it's cleared from the body through the kidneys, so we have to use some mechanisms to protect the kidneys and help the kidneys clear the drug from the system. We use a lot of fluids, a lot of IV fluids for that. So we have to watch the blood counts and make sure the levels in the blood are going down after the drug is given. So this usually has to be done in the hospital. So you will be seen by a team of experts who are really familiar with this process, knows the timing and when to give these drugs and the adjustments that are required. But this will usually require some hospitalization. Another important thing that I wanted to talk about is some long-term effects from the lymphoma on the memory and the thinking. The lymphoma itself can cause some brain damage, and there's real concern of further damage from the therapy. Radiation therapy is something that we use to give a lot for brain lymphoma, and it frequently carries these long-term cognitive effects. So the field, as it evolves, we've been really deliberately trying to protect the brain's function over the long run and focusing more on the chemotherapy, on biologic agents that also cross the blood-brain barrier, but try to spare us from the radiation. So this is what I really wanted to take away, is that the symptoms can vary, but they can come early. Do not tough it out and just hope it's going to pass. The team much rather hear from you. So we treat side effects ahead of time and not after an afterthought. It's much easier to tackle them when they are starting. So if you're a patient, really lean on your caregiver, lean on the people who are there to help you. And the caregivers, don't forget to take care of yourself too. It's very important. We don't want two sick people at the same time. But keep this very simple rule in mind. If you see something, say something. So if any new symptoms, something you're not sure, it's a fever, severe headache, or a new weakness or a sudden change or how you're thinking, just call the team. We want to know. Don't ever hesitate to share. So primary CNS lymphoma is a difficult diagnosis. I will not pretend otherwise, but it's one that we know how to fight. The outcomes are getting better and better, and you're not doing this alone. So I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I know my colleagues will now talk about research and how it's shaping these treatments and how you can get most of your care team. So thank you for your attention. Hopefully this was helpful.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alan Carr. And our next speaker is Dr. James Rubenstein, and Dr. Rubenstein is Professor of Medicine in Residence, Attending Physician in Hematology Oncology, University of California, San Francisco, member UCSF Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Rubenstein will be discussing the role of clinical trials and how research contributes to your treatment options. Now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Rubenstein.
Today, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure and honor to participate today again with Dr. Alan Carr and Dr. Juan and the team here to talk about primary CNS lymphoma, the role of clinical trials and research. So as it was alluded to, I'm professor of medicine at UCSF. I'm a hematologist and oncologist. I have some training in neuro-oncology as well in part of my fellowship. And I do basic lab research on primary CNS lymphoma, as well as participate in clinical practice and variety of clinical trials. I also attend on the malignant hematology service. So I've been here as a fellow since 1995. In 1998, when I first started working on this disease, primary CNS lymphoma was considered to have the same prognosis as glioblastoma, grade 4 astrocytoma. It was thought to be incurable with a median survival of about 12 months. And the treatment at that time I was quite familiar with because of my fellowship training was quite morbid. It was centered around whole brain radiation. The treatment and practice guidelines for primary CNS lymphoma have evolved enormously since then, and the basis for that has been centered on clinical trial research, which has been the pathway to the rational evaluation of novel treatments and the evolution of our treatment approach away from whole brain radiation towards chemotherapy and now towards the integration of novel agents that address the biological principle, the biological components of CNS lymphoma. CNS lymphoma is a genetic disease like all lymphomas. It's the basis for it is through mutations in normal lymphocytes, which through bad luck, the wrong mutations lead to uncontrolled growth. There's a tropism or a propensity of the lymphoma cells, in this case, to grow only in the brain because of biological reasons, where there maybe are growth factors that stimulate the survival and the of lymphoma cells, and that accounts for the natural history of this disease, in which there's patients are diagnosed with a neurologic symptom or present with a neurologic symptom, and ultimately a tissue diagnosis is obtained, and under the microscope, usually lymphoma is diagnosed, and systemic staging eliminates the possibility of there's lymphoma elsewhere. That is primary CNS lymphoma. So in 1998, as I said, this was considered a incurable disease, and whole brain radiation was this basically the consolidation route of choice, which represented a significant advance, actually, when I was a medical student. This is survival of this disease was less than a year, and it was through work done at Memorial Sloan Kettering initially that evaluated combined modality therapy. That means the combination of two different types of regimens, chemotherapy and radiation, that led to the evidence that their long-term survival could be achieved in a minority of patients beyond 1 year. But it was very evident at that time that whole brain radiation was associated with substantial morbidity, neurologic morbidity. That means patients are very sick and there's neurocognitive dysfunction and a variety of neurologic toxicities that were permanent from the radiation were evident over in a time-dependent manner. That means after about 6 months to 2 years, patients began to have neurologic compromise. And so it was very evident in the late 1990s, early 2000s, that brain radiation needed to be replaced with something else. And so I had the honor and opportunity to participate in some of this early research to look at how to get rid of brain radiation through and cure this disease with the rational integration of the tools we had at the time, one of which was to integrate the newly approved antibody against lymphoma cells called rituximab, which attacks a molecule called CD20, which happens to be expressed on 98% of primary CNS lymphoma cells. The other was the integration of high-dose chemotherapy as an option compared to whole brain radiation. And we did a trial with a combination of the standard drug methotrexate plus a well-tolerated, relatively well-tolerated alkylating agent called temozolomide, which was derived from its use in glioblastoma, and combined that with methotrexate and did exploratory studies combining that with rituximab, which in the late 1990s was still still unclear what the neurologic toxicity of rituximab might be. And through an early phase trial, which I wrote at the end of my fellowship, basically we were able to develop a regimen that combined those three agents and then also evaluated a novel consolidation and using two strong chemotherapy drugs. And that led to a phase one trial. Phase one trial is a type of trial in which you investigate purely the safety of a novel agent or a novel combination in a small number of patients, and you look for safety signals or dose-limiting toxicity. If the combination of drugs appears to be safe, then we go on to phase two trials. Phase two trials evaluating a larger number of patients for safety and beginning to look for efficacy signals, how well the drug and combination works in small numbers of patients, generally less than 100. And then the third major type of clinical trial is called a randomized phase three trial, in which one regimen, which is well established, is tested against a new regimen in a randomized way, where patients are patients who consent to the trial are allocated one of two agents or combinations of agents or treatments, and the relative safety and efficacy are compared. And generally, these patients are aliquoted equally in distribution in terms of age and other biological features so that their results are scientifically rigorous and allow investigators across the world to interpret them in meaningful ways. So those are the three phases of clinical research. Phase one, safety only, early efficacy signals. Phase two, looking for efficacy and further safety signals, and then phase three, a randomized, scientifically rigorous evaluation of one regimen versus another that allows us to move forward in terms of determining standard of care in the most rigorous manner. So in CNS lymphoma, the clinical trials that are really have moved the field forward are those that have first, since 1998, and gotten rid of whole brain radiation, are those that have evaluated dose-intensive chemotherapy consolidation as opposed to whole brain radiation, bringing autologous stem cell transplant, a very important modality, as well as etoposide ARA-C, another modality which is non-myeloablative, into the forefront. There are other regimens, a variety of transplant regimens that have been considered and evaluated and in phase two trials showing efficacy. And then importantly, there have been several randomized trials that have proven that dose-intensive chemotherapy, either mainly autologous stem cell transplant, is superior to brain radiation in terms of neurocognitive outcomes, and in one case, showing much more profound efficacy, putting to rest, in general terms, the use of whole brain radiation in most cases as standard, because as alluded to earlier, brain radiation has proven to be neurotoxic, particularly in patients aged greater than 60, which is a major fraction of patients with this disease. So dose-intensive chemotherapy has moved the field forward. Getting rid of whole brain radiation is now standard for consolidation for most patients. However, in the last 15 years, there's been elucidation of novel agents that have addressed more cleanly the principal biological components of CNS lymphoma, and these have slowly been integrated into clinical practice, and now we're using them in early phase investigations, clinical trials, phase one trials mainly, to evaluate how we can use these to eliminate the toxicity of dose-intensive consolidation altogether. And Dr. Alan Carr is leading one of the principal studies, which we're looking at a drug called lenalidomide, which we initially evaluated in phase one trials here at UCSF. Dr. Alan Carr is conducting a phase one national study now, looking at lenalidomide and lenalidomide maintenance as a way to provide long-term survival and potentially durable remissions in patients without dose-intensive chemotherapy. And this is focused on the increasing population of patients that we have who are not good candidates for auto transplant, autologous stem cell transplant, or dose-intensive chemotherapy consolidation with etoposide ARA-C, generally patients age greater than 70. So we've gone from standard of care being whole brain radiation to standard of care being dose-intensive chemotherapy consolidation, which is actually quite cumbersome and risky as it, in itself, because it requires inpatient hospitalization, to now doing consolidation, and to now using maintenance therapy with biological targeted agents that address the biological principles of this disease to improve quality of life, hopefully. So this is the future of CNS lymphoma, is to get rid of chemotherapy, hopefully altogether, and to use combinations of agents that can promote long-term survival. The trial that Dr. Alan Carr is running also has been evaluating a novel immunotherapy agent in this disease called nivolumab, which is a T-cell activator or T-cell. It activates the adaptive part of the immune system. Basically, it activates T-cells, which have poor activity in CNS lymphoma, and it's intended to stimulate their activity in a safe way. And phase one trials is evaluating the safety of that component as well. So it's we're going much more into in clinical research, is evaluating, importantly, these novel agents and moving them into phase one trials and hopefully phase two trials. And hopefully we'll ultimately get rid of chemotherapy altogether and be able to cure people based upon the rational allocation and sequence of targeted agents which address the biology of CNS lymphoma. So what is the biology of CNS lymphoma? Well, the biology of CNS lymphoma is, as I said before, it's a genetic disease wrought by specific mutations of B cells, which are immune cells that normally do a great job for us in fighting infection. They make antibodies. You couldn't have antibodies against COVID if it weren't for the B cells, because they respond to the vaccines or the infection itself to make specific antibodies to a pathogen such as COVID, which have not been seen before by the body. So how can an immune cell make an antibody, a specific antibody against something it's never seen before, something that we didn't know existed on the planet? Well, lymphocytes make mutations in their DNA, and that these mutations randomly allocated ultimately rarely will produce antibodies that are highly specific and efficacious. And the cells that make those antibodies make high affinity antibodies that are neutralizing and save your body from the pathogen. So we're dependent on this the ability of B cells to make random antibodies in great numbers. And over time, unfortunately, if you live long enough, the cost of having this mutational ability in your lymphocytes is that occasionally there's a mistake made in the DNA. Instead of making a good antibody that helps you, there are mistakes in the DNA that lead to uncontrolled growth and proliferation of the B cells, and that's what lymphoma is. And so we're beginning to understand what those mutations are and how those lead to uncontrolled growth. And that leads to novel therapies. It leads to novel ways of making the diagnosis of this disease. And it also has led us to understand better the different types of this disease. There are different subtypes, we believe, that have different prognoses, and that is important in terms of understanding risk stratification. That is how we decide which patients need which therapies. So understanding the biology is critical to understanding the prioritization of novel agents or specific agents for different patients with different disease types, something called personalized or precision medicine. So there are multiple areas of research in this disease, one of which is understanding imaging. MRIs are typically used, and MRIs to make the diagnosis or to facilitate the diagnosis to help the surgeon decide where to make a biopsy. There's a lot of research being done to use MRIs to tell us more about the biology of this disease, whether the tumor is active, and to determine whether the tumor is going to be very aggressive or not, or indolent. So MRI can tell us important information. There's a wealth of information from these MRIs, and we're doing research now to apply that to determine prognosis and when to stop treatment, and learning how to use MRI tools to determine when to stop treatment. Another line of investigation or research is the problem of getting drugs into the brain. That is a very important problem in this disease. It's integral to the limitations of therapy so far, and that's caused by the blood-brain barrier. So it's been established for many years that many of the drugs that we're interested in don't get in the blood into the tumor because of the blood-brain barrier. So we're currently studying the ability of small molecules to get across the blood-brain barrier in that can target lymphoma. We've done research on the intratumoral or intra-CSF administration directly of targeted agents such as rituximab to get across the blood-brain barrier, and showing that can help patients in both with CSF brain disease as well. So that's a novel research-driven strategy which still has great potential, because there's no getting around the blood-brain barrier. There's been for years people have been looking at agents that just potentially disrupt the blood-brain barrier as well. And current interest is in the ability of novel antibodies such as the anti-CD19 antibodies, tafasitamab, or T-cell engagers to get across the blood-brain barrier to enhance disease responses, because these agents also have anti-lymphoma activity. And then in terms of diagnosis, the spinal fluid is also full of biological information that can facilitate early diagnosis, so patients don't have to wait many months, hopefully, to get the diagnosis or even get a brain biopsy. So there are genetic tests that are able to use the CSF to make the diagnosis, such as a MYD88 mutation or certain proteins that can facilitate diagnosis as well by analysis of the spinal fluid. And finally, the another route of research is novel immunotherapeutic strategies, as I alluded to before, T-cell engagers or T-cell stimulators such as nivolumab. And then there's this current phase one investigation is looking at the ability of cellular therapy such as CAR engineered T-cells or CAR T-cells for their ability to actually penetrate the brain and eliminate recurrent lymphoma that is resistant to chemotherapy or radiation. So that's an important area as well, and that's moving forward actively. And then finally, the last two areas are the molecular genetics of the disease. We've shown that, and a number of investigators have shown, I've identified the panoply of mutations, the spectrum of mutations that are associated with CNS lymphoma pathogenesis. We have evidence that there are four genes can account for a significant number of the high-risk patients, and mutations in these four areas or four of the genome constitute potentially high-risk disease with methotrexate, temozolomide, rituximab, chemotherapy. And another group has replicated some of our findings, a group from Japan showing that mutations in two of the genes that we found are also important in their data set. It's a smaller study, but it shows that this is the reproducible research can be right across continents and different subtypes of disease. Theirs was in ocular lymphoma. Ours was in primary CNS lymphoma. But it shows, provides further evidence that there are different risk groups, genetic risk groups for this disease. And we've shown that the low-risk group has excellent responses to non-myeloablative therapy and MTR, and the higher-risk group has worse inferior responses. And that's a risk group in which research needs to be applied to help patients with mutations in the high-risk group of genes. And then finally, the last area of research has to do with toxicity of therapy. This is this has been critical to moving forward. Neurocognitive testing, looking at the damage caused by the lymphoma, the injury, some of which is definitely can be overcome through neurocognitive therapy. And some of which is caused by the treatment, has been integral to moving this field forward. Neurocognitive testing has shown that dose-intensive chemotherapy is less toxic than whole brain radiation. We're going to continue using neurocognitive testing to evaluate novel therapies ultimately in these larger studies. And the neurocognitive testing can be has many different levels. The most simplest test is the mini mental status examination. But there are other more sophisticated tests done longitudinally done by psychologists, which are integral to understanding toxicity assessments, because many of the chemotherapy drugs are also toxic as well, not only in brain radiation, and the disease itself, unfortunately, has some neurocognitive and deleterious effects on the motor system. And finally, quality of life assessments is also integral. It's also an integral component of research in ultimately and finding the safest, most effective therapy which preserves quality of life for our patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rubenstein. And our next speaker is Dr. Jia Ron. And Dr. Ron is Professor of Clinical Medicine, Weill Cornell Medicine Lymphoma Program, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology. And Dr. Ron will be discussing quality of life concerns, key questions to ask your healthcare team, as well as guidelines to prepare for telehealth/telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. Now, my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ron.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here. I want to thank Cancer Care for this opportunity to discuss CNS lymphoma, which is a very important topic and one of my clinical and research interests. I also want to thank my colleagues, Dr. Alan Carr and Dr. Rubinstein, for giving such a great comprehensive introduction in terms of the CNS lymphoma treatment landscape, as well as the importance of clinical trials. And without that, you know, we just simply cannot advance. And I have to say that, you know, just in the past decades, as you've heard, that there's significant advancement in terms of providing much better treatment, and to the point that we have durable response, remission, and potentially cure for our patients. So I'll move along and, you know, discuss today about quality of life concern, which is such an important and relevant topic in CNS lymphoma because, you know, the disease and aggressive treatments affect the brain directly. So patient and also a family and a caregiver frequently deal with, you know, symptoms such as memory loss, executive dysfunction, emotional and personality changes, all of which, you know, affect their daily living and quality of life. The quality of life issue for CNS lymphoma patients, you know, centers very heavily on managing those symptoms that's involving, you know, cognitive decline, very specific neurological disability from both the disease and also the treatment. There are short-term and long-term neurotoxicity and constitutional side effects like profound fatigues from the treatment. And so those are very unique issues that pertaining to both patients and their family caregivers. So I want to give you some examples, just like maybe elaborate a little bit more on those, you know, particular quality of life issues. They certainly include this cognitive decline and neurological symptoms. Because the CNS lymphoma has infiltrative nature involving the brain and the intensive treatment, the target of the treatment is also the brain, particularly as you've heard, high-dose methotrexate and all the other novel agents. We're kind of banking on the fact that they can go there and, in fact, to be effective. So they could, you know, both the disease and the treatment can lead to impaired attention, some memory loss, executive dysfunctions, and even some of the symptoms may persist, some of which could be reversible, you know, after the CNS lymphoma has been treated and eradicated on your scan, for example. And there's also neurological symptoms, and that really has to do with the location of the tumor and the effect on the brain structure. They could manifest with, like, headaches, sometimes seizures, vision change, you know, hearing loss, and physical weakness in, you know, arms, legs, and just in general coordination. There's also very profound fatigues. A lot of them could be related to the lymphoma treatment. That's actually a very commonly reported physical symptoms after getting treatment for CNS lymphoma. And as you can imagine, all of those could significantly impacting a patient's independence and also, you know, in terms of carrying out the care plan, both by the patients and their family members. There's also, you know, a social and occupational disruption that is coming after, you know, we do assessment for their physical disability, but that's very profound, you know, because they would hinder a patient's ability to, obviously, for their work, professional career, and, in fact, navigating social interactions or just very basic, you know, exchange with their families. And that also brings a very profound feeling of isolation and social function. And there's also possibly neuropsychiatric effect, for example, that could be sometimes manifestation of CNS lymphoma. Patient might have apathy, depression, agitation, and that certainly affect their quality of life. And in addition, there's also, you know, they're facing, both patients and family facing quite a bit of uncertainty that's involving managing their care and what's coming afterwards, you know, what to expect, what's the extent of recovery and how that's going to be translating into their life afterwards. In terms of our care for patient quality of life, that we work in a multidisciplinary fashion. For example, in our center, we work very closely with our neuro-oncology colleagues. We work with our psychology colleagues. We work very, very closely with our rehabilitation physicians, our gastrointestinal specialist, nutrition, dietitian. All of them are providing, contributing to the multifaceted care. So I think it's really important that you find a team that you can communicate very effectively and you have good trust to kind of carry forward a very comprehensive and sometimes quite complex management plan so that you feel like you have a good supportive network. And there's also external resource like Lymphoma Research Foundation, you know, for example, cancer care, you know, this particular featured topics that contribute to that. There are studies, in fact, showing that if patient responding to treatment, you know, particularly the systemic high-dose methotrexate-based chemotherapy, that the quality of life, performance, and cognitions, they would gradually improve over time. So that would be something to monitor and watch out to, suggest a positive response in patients who's getting those treatment, even before, you know, the difference can be detected, physically, objectively on scan, per se. And quickly, you know, before I move on to the next question, I want to just kind of share our observation, you know, in terms of what's our approach to various quality of life issue. In our practice, for example, you know, majority of our patients, I would say more than 50% patients would come in indeed with significant cognitive decline, functional disability, that they would, lose their baseline independence. And a typical course for caring for those patients, they may spend a lot of time in the hospital getting high-dose methotrexate, be monitored very carefully, and starting to have some rehabilitation plan in place. And our goal eventually would, you know, have patient transition to a rehabilitation center. Depending on their capability, you know, they can go to acute or subacute facility where there's a lot of interaction with caregivers in both inpatient and outpatient settings. And I must say that the initial care is a very critical stage to gauge, you know, the treatment is, you know, strong enough to be effective, but also it's safe enough that side effects can be mitigated so that we don't have any organ dysfunction. And the effective communication would also be required to so that, you know, it's easier to make a discussion and have adjustment made based on the interim assessment. So I think, you know, as you can hear, it involves a lot of patience and trust in the healthcare team to get to the interim analysis, and before this process can be going to more or less of a cruise mode. There are also, patients who come in with more independent status, and they have, you know, more limited side effects, limited symptom and side effects, and we would support them to have treatment, you know, conducted inpatient, but also a lot of rehabilitation to be carried out in the outpatient setting to seek second opinions and to discuss clinical trials so that we can maximize long-term lymphoma-free longevity and balance against the side effects of treatment effects. In fact, for example, recently, Dr. Rubenstein and I, we shared patients. We had a lot of discussion regarding what's the best option for example, consolidation or maintenance, if we get to that after induction treatment. So, you know, I think that quality of life is front and center throughout the care plan for patients with CNS lymphoma. Next, in the interest of time, I will move to key questions to ask your healthcare team. You know, I think the most important question is always initial interaction that to understand the, CNS lymphoma diagnosis, you know, stagings, and discuss about treatment options to be familiar, which may take, you know, multiple discussions and just experience the treatment course in terms of what kind of regimens, you know, ingredients, and some timeline, which is important for planning purpose, you know, how long the patient's going to be in the hospital, how long rotating out, if they cannot take in care the patient in the, you know, home settings, what are the opportunity and options and to provide, you know, comprehensive multidisciplinary care. And there's also asking about other advocacy, you know, agency or society like Leukemia Lymphoma Society, Lymphoma Research Foundation, patient focus group, et cetera. And your primary oncologist and their team really is, you know, one huge important resource in guiding through all of this journey. Now, guideline to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments. I think, you know, it's such an important, it's a newer modality, but it's really very important, you know, because we actually, you know, adapt or employ that often just because you can imagine that for treatment of CNS lymphoma, it's a very frequent treatment cycle. And actually, majority of the times, sometime would be spent in the inpatient setting if this were to be high-dose methotrexate-based. We want to maximize our patients' time at home or a rehab sort of outpatient setting. So I think telemedicine is a good option in between to check in, making sure that, you know, the schedules are discussed, you know, if any kind of pertinent question regarding medication, side effects, and subsequent planning can be discussed sort of on a frequent base, you know, because situation may change. And so I think that this is really a very, you know, helpful, you know, modality to take into consideration as part of your care plan. I want to stop here and leave time for question and discussion. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ron. And our next speaker is Ms. Jennifer LaPietra. And Ms. LaPietra is the Patient Assistant Program Manager as well as one of our oncology social workers here at Cancer Care. And Ms. LaPietra will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services as well as our Hope Line and website. It's now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. LaPietra.
Thank you so much, Ms. Nazarian, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining this call. It is an honor to participate in today's program. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and potential financial assistance. In my role at Cancer Care, I provide supportive services to individuals and families impacted by a cancer diagnosis. A cancer diagnosis can be overwhelming. Additional support and guidance, as well as establishing a support network, may help to relieve feelings of anxiety related to one's diagnosis and may be addressed through psychosocial supportive services. making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, and communication with one's medical team are important topics that can be discussed in counseling with an oncology social worker or by participating in a support group. Joining a support group may be a way of connecting with others who go through similar experiences and can understand what you encounter throughout diagnosis and treatment. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through similar experiences as you are, obtain information, and provide support. Currently, Cancer Care offers several cancer-specific support groups online. The Cancer Online Support Group aims to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, increase feelings of empowerment, provide practical information about treatment and resources, and address ways to communicate with one's medical team and loved ones. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and group members must register to join. You can register for an online support group through cancercare.org by selecting Our Services, then Support Groups. After completing the registration process on our website, members can participate by posting in the groups 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout treatment, and it may be helpful to discuss your concerns with your medical provider. It may also be helpful to speak with an oncology social worker, a patient navigator, and the financial department at the treatment center to see if there are any financial options available for you. Cancer Care's Resource Navigation offers a short-term, strengths-based approach service to both patients and caregivers. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. On Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, you will find an array of reading material and information related to cancer, as well as stories of help and hope. If you are interested in learning more about the support services we offer, I encourage you to call Cancer Care's National Hopeline at 800-813-4673 and speak with one of our oncology social workers. Our oncology social workers are trained on how a cancer diagnosis can impact an individual as well as their loved ones. Please know that we are here to offer you support throughout your experience. Thank you for your attention and opportunity to speak in this informative program. I will now turn our program back to Ms. Nazarian.
Thank you very much, Ms. LaPietra. We are now going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, and our first question is for Dr. Alan Carr. What about indolent SL entering CNS?
So we do have a smaller proportion of the brain lymphomas that are the low-grade lymphomas, like marginal zone lymphomas, or even sometimes SLL or CLL. So yes, or mantle cell lymphoma rarely in the brain as well. So these lymphomas can happen as primary CNS lymphoma, generally more frequently a secondary CNS lymphoma, as it happens with mantle cell lymphoma or CLL. The marginal zone lymphomas are generally of the lining of the brain called dura. So yes, the great majority are diffuse large B-cell lymphomas, but we can have low-grade lymphomas in the brain as well, and the management will be potentially a little bit different. If it's low-grade lymphomas sometimes involving the dura, we may try to radiate them, reset them, so it can be a little bit different. So what we discuss mainly today applies especially for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma of the brain, and the less common presentations, the approach will change a little bit.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alan Carr. A question for Dr. Ram. How does a non-medical person identify symptoms of PCNSL?
Hi. So thank you for the question. I think it's a good question. I feel like this could be, at different levels. Some symptoms are subtle. Others are not, So I think majority of the patients in our practice that are coming through our care that usually have fairly, significant weakness, for example, they couldn't move some part of the arm or legs that they, they're very different in terms of their energy level and weakness. So we call that focal, so have some kind of lateral, some location attached to that. But I think it's a good question because sometimes it could be really very subtle. It could be forgetfulness, for example, changing memory, just personality. So I think that takes perception and early detection, for example. So it could be potentially challenging. We occasionally see patients or primary care physician refer very, very early with very subtle symptoms, and a early workup also seems to be really very comprehensive. And as you would imagine, that would require a brain imaging such as a CT scan, but even better, a MRI of the brain that sometimes can be quite revealing. So I think it's, just kind of alert, just alertness or, being, being thoughtful about those symptoms, and always do not hesitate to bring up some of the side effects, symptoms to your primary care physicians if you're worried, concerned enough.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ron. Another question for Dr. Alencar. What resources for clinical trials are available to medically underserved populations?
That is a critical question, and there are different ways that I can answer this question about medically underserved populations. One is making sure that you have access to the care, right? So making sure that we use all our reach of our cooperative groups, collaborations with local communities to make sure that these studies are available to all patients, being in large academic medical centers and smaller centers in the local communities. It's very, very important that these studies, that we work towards having these studies available in all sites. And obviously, treatment of primary CNS lymphoma is complex, as you have seen, so it will tend to be, these studies will tend to be present and available more frequently in larger centers, but still making sure that we have the proper screening and access through all these sites is very important. And the other is also making sure that the studies reflect all these populations. So when we're developing studies, developing criteria for enrollment, that we keep in mind the details of underrepresented and minority populations, make sure that they are included and represented in these studies, because there will be subtle differences and on the biology of the disease, on the way this disease presents, and we want to make sure they're properly represented on the studies.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alencar. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. So just a brief takeaway for our participants for today. We'll start with Dr. Alencar, then Dr. Rubenstein, then Dr. Ron, and then Ms. La Pietra. So Dr. Alencar.
Thank you. And I probably just realized that I took Dr. Rubenstein's question because this was on clinical trials. So Dr. Rubenstein, my apologies for that. But I think the takeaway is first to thank Cancer Care for this. This is very, very important. I think that knowledge is power. Understanding the disease, understanding the presentation, understanding what to expect really empowers you to go through this battle. Better equipped. It's never easy. It is very difficult for patients and for the family, as it is for us, the providers, the team helping you. So the more aligned we are, the better we understand, and the more information we get back from you, the better it will be for the therapy, the more specific we will be on our management. So communication is key, but knowledge is power. So thank you, Cancer Care, for giving us the opportunity to share our knowledge about the disease and really providing the opportunity for patients and families to learn about it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alan Carr. And Dr. Rahm?
Yes, I want to echo what Dr. Alan Carr just said, and particularly on the topic of, you know, quality of life and deliver a very comprehensive care. So indeed, to know as much and information as there is for the diagnosis and treatment, but also, you know, to have a very, I would say, effective communication with your care team, and to find out what are the symptoms or you know, that are reversible and what might be lingering, so that, you know, your expectation in terms of treatment, you know, the objectives, and also how that's going to affect, you know, your organization of care, you know, home life, that can be, you know, realistic. And I think that is very helpful discussion, I always find, for our patient once they have a realistic assessment and know what can be achieved and how to get to that. That generally makes our, you know, care journey very productive.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wong. And Ms. LaPietra?
Just stress that all of us here at Cancer Care are available to assist and provide any support, guidance, and resources to help you navigate this process. And we encourage you, when you go to your medical appointments, to write down your questions beforehand, because it can be really overwhelming in that space and you might forget something that you really wanted to ask and learn more about. We also recommend writing down the answers to those questions using a phone app or a notebook, something that's convenient and feasible for you, or bringing a family or a loved one with you so that they can help you listen to the information. Thank you so much for today's program. I hope that you benefited from listening to the panel.
Thank you very much, Ms. LaPietra. And now I just want to take a moment to thank all of our speakers today. We had a phenomenal panel, and I also want to thank our participants. Today's program was particularly exceptional because of the questions that were asked on the call and the way that they were answered by our speakers. I do want to say a few words, though, for those of you that didn't have your question answered, or you were typing your question up in queue, or even if you did have your question answered, I'd like you to go back to your healthcare team and ask them your questions. Please remember that you've learned a great deal from today's program, and I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions again and again. I also want to say I don't want anyone to leave this workshop feeling as if they are alone, because you are not alone. You have a community of support here at Cancer Care. Thank you all again for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.